So we'll get to reading in just a moment. I've never had the privilege of building a house. Not that I could actually build a house, but I would love to be able to watch somebody else build my house. That would be really exciting for me. So I don't anticipate that happening anytime in this lifetime, but I do like to walk through other people's houses as they're being built. And it's kind of nice, you know, when it's being built, usually there's no doors on there. You can just sort of walk through and see the framing and, you know, what's going to happen, what it's going to sort of imagine, you know, where the walls are going to be, and especially dormers. Those are so neat as they're being constructed. But I remember we took a couple of mission teams to New Orleans, one in 2007 after Katrina, and then one 2 years later in 2009. And it was just such a thrill to go back and see some of the same houses that we worked on. And we were just gutting, you know, ripping out, just, you know, shoveling out mud and, you know, rotten wood, just to go back 2 years later and see these houses completely done, and to see them full of, you know, new floors and new windows, and full of pictures and families, just full of life. It's a beautiful thing. And I can't imagine what, you know, those people that have or had homes in Mexico Beach or Panama City are going through right now. It's devastating. And if you have an interest in getting involved in that, our disaster relief through Mission to North America is getting ready to head down there. So my prayer is with a lot of help and some time, they'll get to see that experience of seeing these homes rebuilt. But there's nothing like seeing a house under construction and seeing, you know, first the framing and then seeing these blank spaces get filled in with drywall, and then seeing trim go up and windows and doors, and then seeing it get painted. That's the best part, actually, the painting. That's what I used to do. But it's just to see it become this beautiful home for a family. It's a wonderful thing. So if you're not a construction expert, or like me, a construction nerd — I'm not a construction expert in any sense of the word — if you're not either of those, you might, you know, look at the words in this chapter and think, how could this possibly have any relevance for us? You might think of taking a nice long nap for the next 30 minutes, but I just want to be honest with you and tell you that, as I was reading through this at the beginning of the week, I felt the same way. I thought, oh, dear Lord, what am I going to do with this? But thankfully, I have the blessing of a past and present community. So, you know, I don't read the Bible in a vacuum. I get to consult with other people, some who are alive, some who are dead. But they all encourage me, and they bring their insights into this passage. And so I've gotten some help, and I'm very grateful for that. And I'm convinced there's a ton of relevance in this chapter. So hang with me, and we're going to look at it together. The last couple of weeks, we've looked at how Solomon built this temple. This was not his idea. He built it at God's command. He built it in God's will. David, his father, actually laid out the plans. David gathered a lot of the materials. And the plan of the temple the floor plan was actually based on the tabernacle in the wilderness. It was just bigger, and it was more permanent. I won't say permanent because it wasn't permanent, but it was more permanent. And it had great significance. So I want to show you a few things, sort of different windows into why the temple matters, what is important about it. The first thing that the temple was, and there's an outline in your bulletin if you want to follow along, it was a testimony to God's faithfulness. So let's read verse 1. In the 480th year, after the people of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, he began to build the house of the Lord. Now, the end of the... Okay, if you skip to the end, verse 38 sort of bookends the constructions and tells us that after 7 years and 6 months, he finished. So, okay, at the beginning started, at the end he finished. It's a very unassuming verse, verse 1, but there's a lot there. There are some scholars who don't see the number 480 years as literal. Some of them see it as like 12 generations, 40 years each, kind of an approximation. However, there's no real reason not to. because there are specific references to numbers in here. And so I'm taking this as a literal number. You could take it either way, but I'm convinced that it is meant to be a literal number. If you count back 480 years from the fourth year of Solomon's reign, we know when that was. It was 966 BC. You get to 1446 BC for the date that the Israelites came out of slavery in Egypt, otherwise known as the Exodus. So let's turn back to Exodus chapter 12. And I just want to read a couple verses from there that are important. They kind of work together with 1 Kings 6, verse 1. So Exodus 12, 40 and 41 says this: "And the stay of the sons of Israel that they stayed in Egypt was 430 years. And at the end of 430 years, it happened on that very day." This is why I say, I don't think these numbers are just, symbolic. "It happened on that very day, all the hosts of Yahweh went out from the land of Egypt." So in that verse, Exodus 12, 40, 41, the writer, clearly means an actual date, number of years. Israel's sojourn in Egypt started 430 years before that date. You could say 1876 BC or thereabouts, when Jacob's family came down to Egypt to escape the famine in their homeland in Canaan. And before that, in Genesis chapter 15, God had predicted that that was going to happen. Abraham and his descendants would be sojourners in the land that is not theirs, and would be servants there, and they would be afflicted for 400 years. Now, what Ralph Davis was helpful for me, Old Testament scholar, in pointing out that you have two blocks of time, basically. You have two eras that follow one another. Exodus 12:40 marks the end of 430 years of bondage in Egypt, celebrating the gift of freedom. 1 Kings 6:1 over here marked the end of 480 years after that of wandering, celebrating the gift of rest. Now, when you think about Israel in Solomon's day, you might say, well, they've been at rest for a long time. Well, maybe not. Look, if you're still in Exodus, turn over to Exodus chapter 15, verse 17, because this is where you have the Song of Moses. This is where Israel, comes across the Red Sea, they escape Pharaoh's army, and they're throwing a party, and they're singing songs of praise to God. And this is one where he says, "I will sing to the Lord, for he's triumphed, the horse and his rider he's thrown into the sea." So if you fast forward through chapter 15 to verse 17, he says, "You will bring them in and plant them on your own mountain, the place, O Lord, which you have made for your abode, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. The Lord will reign forever and ever." Isn't that amazing? Why are they concerned about a temple, a sanctuary, way back when they're still, getting sand out of their shoes from the Red Sea? What it tells us is the Song of Moses tells us that God always intended for his people not just to get into the land of Canaan, but you could get back to the land of Canaan, but to conquer it and to find rest there. David finished the work of conquest that Joshua started, and Solomon is the one who celebrates rest with the completion of the temple. I mean, just think about the amount of time that had to pass, 430 years, just for them to get back to the land where God had promised them. You have 430 years, you have 480 years. That's a lot of time. God is not in a hurry, is he? I just find, this is my experience in general, we don't tend to fall behind God's pace. He's not generally moving ahead of us. We're generally the one that's chomping at the bit to do something. We want to run ahead of him. Why? Because our plan is so awesome. We're so smart that if only he would listen to us. And it's true that as believers, 2018, where we are right now, there is an urgency about sharing the good news with people. There's no question about that. But there doesn't ever have to be any panic about the kingdom, because God's going to build his kingdom, and thankfully he uses us to do it. And he's not in a hurry. He's got a timetable. And, my experience just in my life is I struggle to accept that and to go with that, because I have my own timetable. So the temple was a testimony to God's faithfulness, and it was a means of finding rest. Because what did they do in the temple? Well, they worshipped, they praised God, they sacrificed, they remembered what God had done in rescuing them from their sins. That's really what rest is all about. Okay, so testimony to God's faithfulness. The second thing I want you to see is that the temple was meant to be a showcase for God's glory. So we have some reading to do here. So first I'm going to read verses 2 through 10. It describes the outside of the temple, make a few comments, and then I'll read verses 14 to 36, which describe the inside of the temple, just so you see where we're going. Oops, sorry, I got to get back to 1 Kings now. All right, starting in verse 2. The house that King Solomon built for the Lord was 60 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, and 30 cubits high. The vestibule in front of the nave of the house, the nave is the main sanctuary, the vestibule was 20 cubits long, equal to the width of the house, and 10 cubits deep in front of the house. And he made for the house windows with recessed frames. He also built a structure against the wall of the house, running around the walls of the house, both the nave and the inner sanctuary, what we would call the Holy of Holies. And he made side chambers all around. The lowest story was 5 cubits broad, the middle one was 6 cubits broad, and the third was 7 cubits broad. For around the outside of the house, he made offsets on the wall in order that the supporting beams should not be inserted into the walls of the house. When the house was built, it was with stone prepared at the quarry so that neither hammer nor axe nor any tool of iron was heard in the house while it was being built. The entrance for the lowest story was on the south side of the house, and one went up by stairs to the middle story and from the middle story to the third. Again, these are all the outside rooms. There weren't any stairs in the inside of the temple. So he built the house and finished it, and he made the ceiling of the house of beams and planks of cedar. He built the structure against the whole house, 5 cubits high, and it was joined to the house with timbers of cedar. So the measure, just so you know, when he says cubit, a cubit is 18 inches long, basically, on average. And so if you just take the cubits, multiply by 1.5, you get the amount of feet. So the temple was 90 feet long, 30 feet wide, 45 feet high, little taller than a four-story building. It was about as big as a church sanctuary that would hold 250 people. It's just it was a good bit taller. You know, obviously, like, a lot taller than this one. But still, not massive by modern standards, but by ancient standards, it was a large building. It would have been by far the largest building in Jerusalem, at least at this point. In fact, there's one Hebrew word that's used for the temple, and it comes from a Sumerian word that means big house, because you know, for that very reason. We'll come back to that phrase, big house. There was also a porch, and then, like I said, there were these rooms around the sanctuary for storage, and they had three different levels. So the outside of the temple was white limestone, and it was prized for its beauty. And what's amazing is that all of the stone, they pre-measured. So they figured out what sizes all the stones need to be to fit together. They quarried, this is why they had 150,000 workers. They quarried all of it away. It was, I think some of it was in Lebanon, maybe most of it may have been in Lebanon. Cut it all there and hauled it all back so that there was no cutting, there was no noise at the site of the temple. Which, you know, it did two things. It made it go faster. Once you bring it back, you just basically set the stones in place, and it moves a lot faster. But it also made a construction site that was virtually silent. And, you know, interesting because you have the prophet Habakkuk who said, "Let the earth be silent before him." So you get this sort of holy hush over. Normally, what does a construction site sound like? It's just obnoxiously loud all the time. This was not the case. Now, one interesting note about the limestone that will come into play later is that this is stone. You know, so this is a very solid construction for the house. But limestone, under intense heat, disintegrates into powder. So that's going to come into play as we get, you know, much further on in our study of 1 Kings or into 2 Kings. Okay, now let's read the section about the interior. This is 14 to 36. So Solomon built the house and finished it. He lined the walls of the house on the inside with boards of cedar. From the floor of the house to the walls of the ceiling, he covered them on the inside with wood. He covered the floor of the house with boards of cypress. He built 20 cubits of the rear of the house with boards of cedar from the floor to the walls, and he built this within as an inner sanctuary, as the most holy place. The house, that is the nave in front of the inner sanctuary, was 40 cubits long. The cedar within the house was carved in the form of gourds and open flowers. All was cedar. No stone was seen. The inner sanctuary he prepared in the innermost part of the house to set there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. The inner sanctuary was 20 cubits long, 20 cubits wide and 20 cubits high, and he overlaid it with pure gold. He also overlaid an altar of cedar. And Solomon overlaid the inside of the house with pure gold, and he drew chains of gold across in front of the inner sanctuary and overlaid it with gold. And he overlaid the whole house with gold until all the house was finished. Also, the whole altar that belonged to the inner sanctuary he overlaid with gold. In the inner sanctuary, he made two cherubim of olive wood, each 10 cubits high, so 15 feet. 5 cubits was the length of one wing of the cherub, and 5 cubits the length of the other wing of the cherub. It was 10 cubits from the tip of one wing to the tip of the other. The other cherub also measured 10 cubits. Both cherubim had the same measure and the same form. The height of one cherub was 10 cubits, and so was that of the other cherub. He put the cherubim in the innermost part of the house, and the wings of the cherubim were spread out so that a wing of one touched the one wall, a wing of the other cherub touched the other wall, their other wings touched each other in the middle of the house. And so they completely spanned the width of the Holy of Holies. And he overlaid the cherubim with gold. Around all the walls of the house he carved engraved figures of cherubim and palm trees and open flowers in the inner and outer rooms. The floor of the house he overlaid with gold in the inner and outer rooms. For the entrance to the inner sanctuary, he made doors of olive wood. The lintel and the doorposts were five-sided. He covered the two doors of olive wood with carvings of cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers. He overlaid them with gold and spread gold on the cherubim and on the palm trees. So also he made for the entrance to the nave doorposts of olive wood in the form of square and two doors of cypress wood. The two leaves of the one door were folding and the two leaves of the other door were folding. On them he carved cherubim and palm trees and open flowers, and he overlaid them with gold evenly applied on the carved work. He built the inner court with 3 courses of cut stone and 1 course of cedar beams. Did you notice how much longer this section is? I did. Remember that no one except the workers who were building the temple and the priests would ever see this, because only the priests could go into the temple when they were doing their work. And the Holy of Holies, this was only the high priest, only one time a year. So isn't it interesting that the writer wants to paint a picture for the people? Now, you know, the writer of Kings is writing to a people who lived later. But he wants God's people to see what many of them would never see, and some of them would see occasionally. I don't know if you were able to watch the virtual tour that I sent a link to. I put it on Facebook and sent it out by email. You know, I thought it was well done and fairly accurate, although, you know, we can always quibble about details. There's some things we really don't know, even based on what is said here. So, as I said before, the outside of the building is limestone. The inside walls are finished in cedar. The floors are cypress, a little bit of a harder wood. The main sanctuary is 60 feet long, 30 feet wide. The Holy of Holies, where the priest went once a year, the high priest, was a 30-foot cube. So again, there's a lot of symbolism here. Number three is a symbol of perfection. So 30-foot cube, 30 high, 30 wide, 30 deep is a symbol of completeness. And over all the walls, you have these carvings of trees and flowers. The Holy of Holies has these cherubim with their wings spread across the whole room over the Ark of the Covenant that itself had cherubim on the cover, which is called the mercy seat. And the entire inside of the building, the entire everything, walls, ceilings, floors, everything, including furniture, was covered in the purest gold. I try to picture, you know, sort of what that might have looked like. It said the man who discovered the tomb of Tutankhamun, I want to say it's Lord Carnarvon, but I'm not 100% sure, but they asked him what it was like, because this was, you know, gold that he was seeing everywhere. And they said, what did you see when you opened the door? And he said, wonders. You know, just wonders. But why such expense? Why such extravagance? We talked a little bit about sort of the application of that idea, but it's important, I think, for us to understand that Solomon's temple was built within time. It was built within a particular culture. There's a reason behind some of this. And in that day, temples were seen as expressions of the power and the majesty of the deity for whom they were built. So Solomon built his temple within that culture to bring glory to God. Gold was the metal of kings. And if you're building a temple for the King of Kings, for goodness sake, why not cover it in gold? He's the king. He's the king of all kings. The problem with these other temples, with these pagan temples, the problem was not necessarily the buildings. It wasn't the way they were. The problem was they were worshiping the wrong God. They weren't worshiping a God who was worthy of all honor and praise and majesty. And Solomon knew that his God was. And he wanted to express that. So there is a godly extravagance that, you know, that we see here. Jonathan Edwards said that God is infinitely the most beautiful and excellent, the foundation and fountain of all beauty. All the beauty to be found throughout the whole creation is the reflection of the diffused beams of that being who hath an infinite fullness of brightness and glory. Don't you love, you know, when you're driving down the road and you see this cloud formation and there's just like a shaft of light coming out of the cloud? There's something about that that just bespeaks God's glory. Yesterday we were at a soccer game for Jacob and Concord, and we saw this beautiful double rainbow. It was kind of sprinkling a little bit, and there was, I mean, it was one of the most vivid rainbows I had ever seen on the inside, and then you had another one, you know, that was fainter on the outside, just like bright yellow, bright red, bright. It was just took your breath away. It was a really competitive game, so it was, you know, sort of torn a little bit. Great rainbow, great soccer game. But what Jonathan Edwards said is that's the reason, well, partly the reason that Solomon had artisans carve trees and flowers and gourds and all of these elements of nature on the walls of the temple. The temple was designed to take God's people back to the first sanctuary. Because what was the first sanctuary? It was the Garden of Eden. It was the God's perfect creation cradling the worship of his first children, Adam and Eve. And that place, just like this temple, was made for his glory. In fact, you could argue the Temple of Solomon was kind of a cheaper imitation of the real sanctuary of Adam and Eve. Psalm 80, verse 1 says, "The Lord is enthroned between the cherubim." So there was a design, there was a reason that it was made the way it was. The Ark of the Covenant was the place. So what this tells us is what he said about the Holy of Holies, about the inner sanctuary, was that was the heart of the temple. That was where the cloud came in when God entered the temple. And as Ezekiel describes, when he departed for the last time, that's where the cloud came out. Now, the tragedy, of course, of the Garden of Eden and that sanctuary was that Adam and Eve didn't get to stay there very long. You know, they broke their covenant with God. They had to leave this perfect temple garden. And in fact, they were made sure that they wouldn't come back by what? By cherubim that were guarding the way. So the design of the temple highlighted that reality. You had doors in the temple, you know, both of the going into the main part and going into the Holy of Holies. So there is a way into the presence of God. And the temple reminded God's people that God made a way for people to have access. The problem is the doors were closed almost all the time. So you have this reality, like there is a way for people to meet with God, but there's a problem. And that's why the doors had to be closed. All access came only through the people that God had designated as the mediators, the priests, because his holiness was not something to be trifled with. And you can only approach God by way of sacrifice. That's what the temple showed the people. So it was designed to be a showcase for the glory of God on earth, a place where God's people could be in awe of his wonder and majesty and re-celebrate his keeping of the covenant through sacrifice, even as they made vows to be faithful to him in response. So we're going to talk about that in a minute, about how that relates to us. But I want to do the last section here. So the third thing is that the Lord's house was a reminder of God's priority. So let's read verses 11 through 13. "Now the word of the Lord came to Solomon concerning this house that you're building. If you will walk in my statutes and obey my rules and keep all my commandments and walk in them, then I will establish my word with you, which I spoke to David, your father. And I will dwell among the children of Israel and will not forsake my people Israel." So here in the middle, and you can see this, you know, when you're reading through this chapter, it's like, what is this stuck in the middle? You have all of this construction stuff. And then, boom, God says something. He stops everything. And he says, verses 11 through 13. And in fact, there are, I would say most scholars think that this was just stuck in by somebody later. It was kind of an afterthought. And there's no question that this was meant to be stuck in, because you could read verses 1 through 10, and then you could read verses 14 to 36 and not miss a beat. But this thing is just sticking there in the middle. Well, there's no question that the writer means for us to realize that this is God who stuck it in the middle. God stopped the construction to tell Solomon something very, very important. Because, you know, everything's kind of humming along, and then it stops. It's kind of an illustration of the principle that emergencies demand a higher priority. And if you've ever been to an ER, you know, you understand this. You're in there with your, with your tonsillitis or your flu or whatever, and you're waiting to be seen. And just when the doctor is, like, walking towards you, you know, about to take you in, there's a trauma case that comes in. Somebody has a gunshot wound or, you know, whatever. And what happens at that point? Sorry. you get put on the shelf, and all the resources get devoted to what is, the crisis at hand. What's the biggest emergency? Let's deal with that. So your tonsillectomy is going to have to wait. So, you know, this is sort of a principle here, that this word from the Lord is more important than all of that construction, because if Solomon gets this wrong, then this is just going to be a big empty building. It's going to be a waste of time for everybody. It's going to accomplish nothing. So I want you to notice that the pronouns in those three verses, 11, 12, 13, are all second person singular. God is not talking to the nation as a whole. He's talking to Solomon as an individual. And we have to notice that. There's a point behind it. And he makes an if-then statement. So this is a conditional statement with three parts. If Solomon would obey his law, he would do three things. Number one, he would keep his promise to David in 2 Samuel 7, and that means peace, you know, continual rule for Solomon's family. Number two, he would dwell with his people. And that's kind of a part of God's promise to David, too. Number three, he would never leave or forsake his people. And that went beyond even what God said to David. Solomon was the head of his people. His obedience as an individual would determine the future happiness and security of the entire nation. How would you like that pressure? Who in the world would want that job? His house, his dynasty, would be affected by his behavior, and so would his house, meaning his temple. And so one man's obedience really can make a difference. I heard a historical example of this the other day. If you're a Civil War buff, on July 2nd, 1863, General G.K. Warren went to the crest of a knoll called Little Round Top outside of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, where there was a battle brewing. And he was the chief engineer of the Federal Army. And that spot, Little Round Top, was just used as a signal post. So there was no, you know, it wasn't defended at all. But Warren happened to go up there on this particular night, and he saw that Confederate troops were forming in the woods down the hill, and they were getting ready to try to take Little Round Top. And he realized if they did, they would outflank and they would roll up the whole left wing of the Union forces, and it would be devastating for the Union Army. And so immediately he sent and got troops and placed them in position to defend that hill. And what was the result? Well, one man's vigilance saved an entire army, because that was a weak spot in their defenses, and he shored it up just in the nick of time. Now, I'll give you an opposite example. Stalin's Soviet Union in World War II, Joseph Stalin was the premier, and in 1941, against all of his officers' recommendations, he refused to evacuate the city of Kiev in the face of the approaching Nazi armies. And as a result, 500,000 prisoners were captured in the city of Kiev in that battle. In 1942, he did a very similar thing. He sent one of his armies into the Ukraine, again, against the recommendation of all of his generals, and the entire army was captured by the Nazis. And so because of one man who happened to be very proud, didn't want to admit he was wrong, but also didn't care about people. Stalin had total disregard for human life. But because of him, you had hundreds of thousands of people and their families who were affected. One man really makes a difference. So it's a good thing for us to remember the impact that one person can make. And we'll come back to that again in a minute. So what in verses 11 through 13, what the Lord was letting Solomon know is that this temple was not the primary thing. It was a reflection of holiness. In this case, the holiness of the king, and it was also a reflection of the holiness of the people. And it was a place that, what Philip Ryken calls a place for spiritual transaction. The building was second to the relationship. And if the relationship collapsed, guess what? So would the building. And that's exactly what ended up happening. So, I want to make some connections between, you know, what we just talked about and our situation today. We've seen that the temple was three things. It was a testimony to God's faithfulness, bringing the people out of Egypt. It was a showcase of God's glory, his majesty and his greatness. And it was a reminder of what was important to God, which was obedience. So what about us? Why don't we have a magnificent temple to meet in? Well, if you'd ever seen some of the other places we met in, this kind of is a magnificent temple. That little chapel at First Baptist Church was kind of rough. It's important that we recognize that there was only one temple. Well, there were actually three temples, but only one at a time. That is not a continuing norm for God's people. It was the place for God's people, Israel, as a geopolitical nation and as God's people, to worship him. When you get to Jesus' day, there is a temple. That's Herod's temple. And Jesus is walking around and he says, "Destroy this temple and I'll rebuild it in 3 days." Well, John makes it clear that Jesus is not talking about, he's talking about his body, because he's going to die and rise again in 3 days. But in that same statement, Jesus alluded to the destruction of that temple. He said, you know what? Someday there's not going to be one stone left upon another. And that's what happened in 70 AD. Paul told the Corinthians, in fact, when I mentioned Ezekiel, Ezekiel records this vision of God's glory leaving the temple. And you know which direction it goes? It goes east, which is where the people were. They were in captivity in Babylon. And so that's a marker, back in the Old Testament in Ezekiel, that God's presence is with his people. It wasn't first with a building. And that's exactly what we have right now. We are the temple for the dwelling of God. We are the temple as the church. And so our buildings don't have the same purpose that the temple had, because this building is not the temple. This building houses the temple. And there's a huge difference between those two things. So we, God's people, we are a testimony to God's faithfulness. How? Well, God rescued us too, didn't he? He rescued us from slavery to our sin. We are a showcase for God's glory. The Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians 4 said, "For God, who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ." We see God's glory in the way that he changes people's lives, in the way that he turns them around from going one way, living for themselves, to going the other way and living for him. That's God's glory. That's his majesty. Paul goes on to say, "But we have this treasure, this glorious message of the gospel, in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us." So we don't need gilded walls and floors. It'd be probably a lot harder to maintain anyway. We showcase God's grace by living out his glory, living for him, sharing our stories, introducing other people to the gospel. Through all of that, we showcase God's glory. We're also a reminder of God's priority of obedience. Because what we saw in this chapter is one man's obedience was necessary in order to secure the blessings of the people. And you know what? One man's obedience was necessary to save. And thankfully, we have one man who actually did that. Adam failed, Solomon failed, but guess what? Jesus didn't. And that's the good news of the gospel. Jesus did what no other man could or did in living and dying for us. What I want you to see about this temple is that Solomon's house and our house, the people of God right here, there's another temple that's coming that we haven't seen yet. Ezekiel described a new temple, and he gives measurements and things, but as you read it, you read his descriptions, you realize, you know what? The math doesn't really work for this. This is not like a physical building. It's more than that. It is something beyond what we can conceive of on this earth. Revelation tells us that there will be no need for a temple in the New Jerusalem because the Lamb is the temple. And Jesus testifies to God's faithfulness. He testifies to God's glory. He is the one that's worked in us. He also testified to God's demand for righteousness because he kept it. He's going to be the one around whom we're going to get to spend eternity sharing our stories and introducing people to so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. You wouldn't believe this. You know, all of these people whose lives we have affected and not even realized it. So in that time, in that place, we're going to know freedom and rest that we can really only imagine now because he is preparing a place for us. And so, you know, my prayer, and I would encourage you to pray this too, ask God to give you patience to wait a little longer and just continue to be faithful in what he's called you to do in this temple, amongst these people, and in the, you know, in the world that he's called you to live in. So let's ask him to give us that grace right now. Father in heaven, I thank you for these beautiful descriptions of this incredible building that was, it was not just a building, because it was a gift to your people to showcase your glory, but it points us far beyond itself. So Lord, I pray that you'd help us to see the glory of this temple, the one that we're a part of, and also the glory of the one that's coming. Jesus, we thank you that you gave your life to open the way, to open the mercy seat for us to have a relationship with the Father. You tore down the veil of that temple and showed the world that that was it. There's no need anymore because you are the way. So, Lord, help us. Give us a passion to see people come to know that reality and come to believe the gospel. And Lord, help us to be committed to this temple, to each other, to loving one another the way that you have loved us, because a lot of times we struggle. So, Lord, give us grace and strength, we pray, even through the sacrament as we celebrate it right now. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.